Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. Remember to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. Now, here's our pastor and teacher, Jim McLarty.
We are continuing our chapter by chapter exposition of the book of 2 Kings. Last week we finished chapter 12, so we will be starting in chapter 13 tonight, but not immediately. You may recall that at the end of chapter 12 last week, after Joash had done so well in rebuilding the temple, one of the last things that we know about him is that he ended up giving money, the treasure, the things that had been stored up by his forefathers in the temple, he ended up giving it to Hazael, the king of Aram. And then we read this rather cryptic thing at the very end of his life. The last two verses of chapter 12 tell us, "And his servants arose and made a conspiracy and struck down Joash at the house of Milo as he was going down to Selah. For Jazachar, the son of Shimeath, and Jehozabad, the son of Shomer, his servants, struck him, and he died, and they buried him with his fathers in the city of David, and Amaziah, his son, became king in his place." And we're not told why it was that his own servants struck him down. Well, we're not told in 2 Kings, but we are told over in 2 Chronicles. So I thought we would do a little cleanup work and start tonight in 2 Chronicles, because the details are really interesting and also informative, because Joash, as I said last week, started out really well. And he was a good king for most of his life, but he ended really badly. Not only because he gave away the treasures of the temple to a foreign king to save his own hide, but also because of this event that led to his servants killing him. And in reading 2 Chronicles, we're going to read yet another statement about the relationship that God has with Israel and Judah, because Israel and Judah have both had this succession of kings, and the pattern is almost redundant at this point. And we're going to see more of that redundancy in 2 Kings, where they do well, God gives them a good king, they do fine, he protects them for a little while, and then as soon as they're comfortable again, as soon as they have food, as soon as they have peace and safety, they chase after their foreign gods, and then God has to punish them, and then turn them over to the foreign kings, and then they're at war again, and then God delivers them, and then God gives them peace and safety, and then they go back to chase. It's the same cycle over and over and over again. Well, at this point, historically, right at this period of time, after the death of Joash and the next couple of kings, God begins sending prophets to Israel and to Judah. It's the next phase in the growth and development of the northern and the southern kingdoms. It's not enough at this point that they have the law of Moses. It's not enough that they have the Davidic covenant. But this is the point at which God actually begins sending prophets to them who start telling them that it's about to go really bad for them and calling them to turn, to repent, to come back to the God of their forefathers, of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And in fact, if you look at the Hebrew Bible, the minor prophets, there's 12 of them, are actually combined as a single book. And that book of 12 prophets begins with the prophet Hosea. And chronologically, the period of time that we're in, that we're going to look at tonight, is the period of time when God begins sending the minor prophets to Israel, starting with Jonah, who we're going to bump into here. His prophetic career did not start in the belly of a fish. He was already a prophet to begin with, which is why God sent him to Nineveh, but he had been a prophet to Israel before that. But this is also then the period of Hosea. This is the period of Micah. This is the period of Amos. This is the period of what are classically known as the minor prophets. And The reason that's important is because the minor prophets speak, this is a phrase that I've used a lot, that they speak with one voice. They all say the same thing. The details differ a little bit. Amos particularly talks about the differences between the high and mighty who live well and the number of poor around them who are not taken care of within Israel. So he really talks more about the social justice end of it. Hosea is told to go take a wife who is an unclean woman, and through the children that they bear, God predicts the future of Israel. But regardless of the perspective that they come from, they all end up saying the same thing, which is God is going to judge Judah, God is going to judge Israel, but he's going to restore them. Every one of the prophets end up saying that because of promises God has already made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because of covenants he has already made with David, because God always keeps his word, despite the fact that Israel and Judah are continually rebelling against God, nevertheless, God is going to keep his word and ultimately make them the kingdom he has promised them they are going to be. And the prophets say that across the board. So there is an eschatological significance to the minor prophets that you really can't miss. When people talk about eschatology, they have a tendency to maybe pick Daniel from the Old Testament, or maybe go look at a little bit of Zechariah or a little bit of Isaiah, Day of the Lord stuff. But they don't seem to recognize that equally the minor prophets predict a time of return. And by the way, Zechariah, who is very prophetic and very eschatological, is in there among the minor prophets. So when you're really studying end times, when you're really talking about what's yet to come, the things that are not done, that are prophesied in the Bible, you have to recognize the significance of Israel, the 12 tribes, the Davidic covenant, the Abraham, Isaac, Jacob promises, because that's all part and parcel of why there are still things to do like the thousand-year millennium, and why there are still things that are going to happen like the time of Jacob's trouble, but he'll be delivered from it. It's really significant to recognize that the minor prophets all say that God is going to restore national Israel. And never be put out of their land again. They say that stuff over and over again. Yes. I remember sitting one time. Oh, it's really early in the message, and I'm already going to make an Elder Ward reference. But I was sitting one time with Elder Ward. We were talking about future for Israel. And I said, how many times does God have to say something for it to be true? My point being, the prophets say it over and over and over and over. And yet so much of the church world denies the whole thing, hook, line, and sinker. It says God is done with Israel. But when I said to Elder Ward, how many times does God have to say something in order for it to be true? He leaned forward, looked at me, smiled, and said, only once. I said, right. If he only said it once, then it's going to come true. But this is one of those things that God says over and over to Israel through several different mouthpieces. And as we're working our way chronologically through 1st and 2nd Kings, this is the period of time when God starts doing that, sending prophets to Israel now that speak for God and that forewarn them that trouble is coming. And some of them speak so eschatologically that they don't just say there's trouble coming and you're going to go to Assyria. But then Babylon, you're going to go into Babylon. They talk about that. There's so many accurate predictions of the nations that are going to conquer, especially the northern tribes. And then by the time of Nebuchadnezzar, the southern tribes going into the Babylonian captivity. But then those same prophets leap forward and talk about a time of trouble such as never was, ever will be again. A time of purging and cleansing and punishing and restoration for national Israel. And so I argue, because they were so accurate about Assyria, and because they were so accurate about Babylon, they're so accurate about Medo-Persia, when Isaiah, 150 years in advance, predicts Cyrus the Persian by name. They're just so accurate. They've got all the other kingdoms accurate and in line. Daniel, of course, predicting all the kingdoms that would persecute Israel post-Nebuchadnezzar with phenomenal accuracy. So there's absolutely no reason to believe that the rest of what they predict won't also very genuinely, literally, historically come true.
Well, this is how Amos ends up. You can't argue with this.
You can't argue with it.
I will plant them in their land that I have given them, and they shall never be lifted, pulled up from the land that I have given them.
And he's not the only one that says it. They say it over and over. By the way, Amos, then Micah, are contemporaries with Isaiah. And so they're all saying the same thing. They're all predicting the same stuff. They're all saying what's going to happen to national Israel. And it always includes things like what Gladys just read. It's always about restoration, being planted in the land, never being moved again. And that simply never happened. But they have, with exacting accuracy, predicted the other kingdoms that surround Israel, that ever persecuted Israel. They have predicted the deportations, and they predicted it accurately. So why would we believe that the return and the restoration is anything other than exactly accurate? You get my point? So anyway, this is the time period when that happens. Now, after two more chapters in 2 Kings, we're kind of there. We're right there at the time of Hosea. And I feel practically compelled at that point to spend some time reading some of the minor prophets because that's the historic juncture where they fit. I don't really know how we'll work that out as far as the website. We may just suspend 2 Kings for a moment and go do Hosea and work through Micah and, you know, any of the other immediate minor prophets, Amos, for example, and then go pick up 2 Kings again where we left off and move finally to the Assyrian captivity that those prophets all prophesy. In two chapters, we will reach Uzziah. And of course, you know that the book of Isaiah begins with, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw God high and lifted up." And so the period of Uzziah is the time of Isaiah. Now, we're not going to take the years it would take to go through Isaiah before we finish 2 Kings, but a couple of the minor prophets are short enough that over the course of just a couple months here in our midweek study, I think we could do good surveys of those minor prophets and understand what Israel was being told, what God was saying to them, what God had prophesied for them, so that we really see how disastrous it is when you get to the end of 2 Kings. And despite all this, they have turned their backs and hardened their hearts against God. So there's a lot to do to get out of 2 Kings. And my druthers, there's a good southern word, my preference is to spend some time in the minor prophets after these next two chapters. So that's what's coming. Now, as I said, Joash was killed by his servants. And why was he killed by his servants? In chapter 24 of 2 Chronicles, we are told the story. Do you remember who Jehoiada was? Does that name mean anything to you? He's the priest. What priest is he? Raised Joash. Exactly right. And so Joash really owes Jehoiada a great deal because Joash became king at a very, very young age. He was just a child. And so he was really raised by, taught by, tutored by, guided by Jehoiada. So after the temple repairs that we talked about last week, let's start in 2 Chronicles 24, verse 20. Then the Spirit of God came on Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, and he stood above the people and he said to them, "Thus God has said, why do you transgress the commandments of the Lord and do not prosper? Because you have forsaken the Lord, so he has also forsaken you." So they, the people, conspired against him, and at the command of the king, they stoned him to death in the court of the house of the Lord. Okay, so this is Jehoiada, who had done so much good for Joash. Now, at the command of Joash, they've killed Jehoiada's son because he called the people out for their evil ways. So thus, verse 22, thus Joash the king did not remember the kindness which his father Jehoiada had shown him, but he murdered his son. And as the son died, he said, "May the Lord see and avenge." Verse 23, now it came about at the turn of the year that the army of the Arameans came up against him. And they came to Judah and Jerusalem, and they destroyed all the officials of the people from among the people, and sent all the spoil to the king of Damascus. Indeed, the army of the Arameans came with a small number of men, yet the Lord delivered a very great army into their hands because they had forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers. Thus they executed judgment on Joash. So the hand of God is now executing judgment against Joash and his people because the king in specific, Joash, forgot about all the kindness that Jehoiada had done to him and sided with the people against the son of Jehoiada because the son had simply called the people out and said, "Return to God. You're not following after God. You're not following after his law." The people killed him. Joash was part of it. And so now God is executing judgment against all of them. Thus they executed judgment on Joash. And when they had departed from him, for they left him very sick, his own servants conspired against him because of the blood of the son of Jehoiada the priest, and murdered him on his bed. So he died, and they buried him in the city of David, but they did not bury him in the tomb of the kings. Now, these are those who conspired against him. We already know these names: Zabad, the son of Shimeath, the Ammonitess, and Jehozabad, the son of Shimrith, the Moabitess. As to his sons and the many oracles against him and the rebuilding of the house of God, behold, these are written in the treatise of the book of the kings. And then Amaziah, his son, became king in his place. So now we know why he was killed by his own servants. It was because the son of his priest, Jehoiada, who had done nothing but good for him, had been stoned publicly, and the king was consenting to it. And so his own servants ultimately turned against him. And that takes us to 2 Kings chapter 13. Thus ends the introduction. So turn to 2 Kings 13. This is about Amaziah, the son who becomes king in the place of Joash. And now you're going to notice that the stories of these next couple of kings are very brief, very quick. It's almost like you can feel the author, who has stretched out a couple times in this book and told us pretty elongated, detailed stories. You can tell now that he's trying to get somewhere. He has a goal in mind, so he's listing the next several kings in succession. He tells you a couple little things about them, and then he just moves on because he's trying to get to the time of Uzziah, and he's trying to get to the series of kings, Hezekiah. He's trying to get to the deportation of Israel into Assyria. And so these next few kings, he just kind of moves through quickly. Chapter 13, in the 23rd year of Joash, the son of Ahaziah, king of Judah, Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, became king over Israel at Samaria. He reigned 17 years. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, and he followed the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, with which he made Israel to sin, and he did not turn from them. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them continually into the hand of Hazael, the king of Aram, and into the hand of Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael. This is one of the things that God is doing successively to the kings, is taking away their land and handing it over to the Arameans, to the Assyrians. In fact, you may remember back in chapter 10, starting in verse 32, it says, "In those days the Lord began to cut off portions from Israel, and Hazael defeated them throughout the territory of Israel. And so cities are being lost. Cities are being turned over. Regions, territory is being lost. People groups are being lost, which is reducing the power of the kings of Israel and of Judah. And this is one of the ways that God is showing his anger against Israel, particularly at this point. Verse 4, then Jehoahaz entreated the favor of the Lord, and the Lord listened to him. For he saw the oppression of Israel, how the king of Aram oppressed them. I just find this fascinating. There's no way to harmonize those two ideas without the concept of God's absolute sovereignty, because you have two huge ideas juxtaposed against each other here. The first big idea is God is angry at Israel. And so he is giving away the land of Israel to the king of the Arameans. But then when the king of Israel cries out to God, God gives him the power to conquer and fight successfully against the king of the Arameans, because God sees the way that the Arameans are treating the Israelites. So get this straight. So God gives the Israelites over to the hand of the Arameans because God is mad at Israel. When the king of Israel cries out to God, God turns that anger to the Arameans because of the way they're treating Israel. And he's the one who was using them to punish Israel. Does this sound familiar? Because we see this several times in the Bible, particularly Isaiah 10 jumps to mind, where God specifically says that he's going to use the Assyrians in order to punish Israel. And then God turns around and punishes the king of Assyria for the haughtiness with which he attacked Israel. And there's no way to successfully harmonize those kinds of concepts without just going, well, God's sovereign. He's just, there's nothing else you can say about it. He can use the Arameans to punish Israel when he's angry at Israel. But then he can turn around and punish the Arameans for treating the Israelites badly. And just for reference, I said Isaiah 10, working from memory. Let's see if I was right. Yes, that's exactly it. Go read Isaiah 10 sometime. Let's read it now. We're there. Let's go to Isaiah 10 for a second, because the parallels are pretty dramatic. Starting in verse 5, woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hands is my indignation. So he's talking about the Assyrians, who is used as the rod of punishment. God has used the Assyrians to punish Israel on purpose. Even calls them the staff in whose hand is my indignation. And I send it, Assyria, against a godless nation. And I commission it against the people of my fury, to capture booty, to seize plunder, and to trample them down like mud in the streets. Yet Assyria does not intend that. In other words, they're not thinking we're serving God. We're punishing God's people in order to satisfy God. They're just doing what they naturally do. Their natural inclination, let's go attack our enemies, Israel. But God takes complete credit for it and says, I'm going to use them to attack Israel. Yet it does not so intend, nor does it plan so in its heart, but rather it is its purpose to destroy and cut off many nations. For it says, are not my princes all kings? Is not Calno like Carchemish? And Hamath like Arpad, or Samaria like Damascus? All he's saying is, aren't these major areas that I've conquered? Look at me go. Verse 10, as my hand has reached to the kingdoms of the idols whose graven images were greater than those of Jerusalem or Samaria. In other words, of course I can take Jerusalem and Samaria. Look at what I've done to kingdoms greater than them. Shall I not do to Jerusalem and her images just as I have done to Samaria and to her idols? So it will be that when the Lord has completed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, he will say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the pomp of his haughtiness, because he has said, by the power of my hand and by my wisdom, I did this. For I have understanding, and I removed the boundaries of the people, and I plundered their treasures. And like a mighty man, I brought down their inhabitants, and my hand reached to the riches of the people like a nest. As one gathers abandoned eggs, I gathered all the earth. And there was not one that flapped its wing or opened its beak or chirped. Is the axe, this is God's asking this question now, is the axe to boast itself over the one who chops with it? Is the saw to exalt itself over the one who wields it? That would be like a club wielding those who lift the club, or like a rod lifting him who is not wood. Therefore, the Lord, the God of hosts, will send a wasting disease among serious, stout warriors. And under his glory, a fire will be kindled like a burning flame. And the light of Israel will become a fire, and his Holy One will be like a flame, and it will burn and devour his thorns and his briars in a single day. And he will destroy the glory of his forest and his fruitful garden, both soul and body. And it will be as when a sick man wastes away, and the rest of the trees of his forest will be so small in number that a child could write them all down. Do you understand what that's all saying? That's a lot of verbiage for God to say, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to use Assyria to go and punish Israel. And yet, because they're going to do it with this level of pride and haughtiness, I will then punish Assyria for the pride and haughtiness with which they go attack Israel. Now, there's just no way, again, to make that all work out if you don't just step back and say, well, God's sovereign. Because he can raise up nations, he can take down nations, he can use the warring nations that surround Israel to punish Israel. But he can also punish those nations because the people they're attacking are God's people. And that's perfectly okay with God, which means it has to be perfectly okay with us. If our thinking, if our theology, if our opinion of God, if our assumptions about what God is like don't allow him to act like that, then we're still not thinking about the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible can do whatever he wants to do, and he still, notice, treats the people of Israel as his chosen, elect, beloved people, so that even when he punishes them, he will protect them from the ones that punish him, and then punish the people who punished Israel on God's behalf. It's fascinating. So that's what you see over here in 2 Kings. Go back to 2 Kings 13. Verse 3, so the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them continually into the hand of Hazael of Aram and into the hand of Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael. Then Jehoahaz entreated the favor of the Lord, and the Lord listened to him because he saw the oppression of Israel, how the king of Aram oppressed them. And yet it was God that gave Israel into the hand of Aram because of the way Israel was rebelling against God. All right, verse 5. And the Lord gave Israel a deliverer so that they escaped from under the hand of the Arameans, and the sons of Israel lived in their tents as formerly. They lived at peace again. So here's another one of those moments. We don't know who this deliverer is. This is like during the times of the judges when God would send them a leader, a hero who would guide them, lead them, and they'd conquer and they'd have peace again. God has given them now another period of peace, delivered them from the Arameans, and so at this moment Israel ought to all collectively say, well, then we need to return to God. You're all nodding. He has clearly taken care of us. He's protected us. He's delivered us. And the oppression had to have been bad because God even ended up seeing the oppression of Israel and how the king of Aram oppressed them. So things had to have been pretty tough in Israel, and now God has delivered them and sent them a leader. And nevertheless, says verse 6, nevertheless, here's human nature, they did not turn away from their sins, the sins of the house of Jeroboam, with which he made Israel to sin, but walked in them, and the Asherah also remained standing in Samaria. When you read this, don't you just sometimes go, what is wrong with you? Mm-hmm. You want to do like the Three Stooges line them up and slap them thing. You just, what are you thinking? But if anything, it demonstrates that this is what human nature is like. If you don't have the Holy Spirit acting as a governor inside you, leading, guiding, teaching, protecting you, showing you the things of God and securing you in God's favor. If you don't have that, you'd be just like these folks. No matter how many times God did good for you. Look, how many times has God been good to America? Over and over again. Over and over. How many wars have we won? Even when we decide to fight ourselves, we ended up being a united nation when it was over. I mean, how many times has God given us abundance and favor and food and peace? How many wars from foreign enemies have been fought on American territory, on American soil? None. Only when we decide to fight ourselves. But other than that, we've been given peace and safety and food and plenty. And so are we worshiping God constantly?
No.
Falling at his feet, thank you, God, for your plenty. Thank you for all the ways you've provided for us. Thank you for the ways you've been keeping us safe. No, what are we doing as a nation? Now, we're seeing how many rules of God we can break in a row. Mm-hmm. Let's see, should we kill babies? Yeah, let's do that. Let's see, what's that other thing? Oh, yeah, does the Bible have anything to say about it? Oh, yeah, it says it's an abomination. Let's legalize it. We'll just let the court say it's okay. It's insane, and yet it's the way it's always been. This is how people are. People, sinful people, want to self-govern. They will not have God reign over them, will not have God rule over them, and they will not have the cause of Christ be their primary cause in their life because they're too busy making themselves their primary cause. And that's exactly what Israel is doing here. Nevertheless, they did not turn away from the sins of the house of Jeroboam, which means they continue to worship foreign gods, chase after gods other than Yahweh. Verse 7, so here's how we punished them. Here's how we dealt with them. For he left to Jehoahaz of the army not more than 50 horsemen and 10 chariots and 10,000 footmen. For the king of Aram had destroyed them and made them like dust at the threshing. That gives you some idea of what the oppression of the king of Aram was really like. When he got done with them, he had so emaciated their army that they didn't even have 50 horsemen and 10 chariots. Completely ill-prepared for war at that point. And so God had to protect them, or they would be completely overrun by the Arameans. Verse 8, now the rest of the acts of Jehoahaz and all that he did and his might, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? And Jehoahaz slept with his fathers, and they buried him in Samaria. And Joash, his son, became king in his place. In the 37th year of Joash, the king of Judah, Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, became king over Israel in Samaria, the northern tribe. He reigned for 16 years, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. Doesn't this get redundant after a while? He did evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not turn away from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, with which he made Israel to sin. But he walked in them, and the rest of the acts of Joash, and all that he did, and his might with which he fought against Amaziah, the king of Judah, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? So Joash slept with his fathers, and Jeroboam sat on his throne, and Joash was buried in Samaria with the kings of Israel. Now this is the second king in Israel, the northern tribes, that is called Jeroboam. So he becomes known as Jeroboam II. And Jeroboam II is named in particular as the king that is reigning during the time that the minor prophets start preaching. And so that's where we get this sort of time stamp, where we understand that this is the period of time when God is now warning Israel. He's not just dealing with them on a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month, year-to-year basis, But he's even sending people to warn them of what's coming. It's not good enough that God has protected them or raised them up or then let their enemies take over or made them hungry or emaciated their army. For all those things God does to them, nevertheless, they don't turn away from their sins. So the next phase of God's dealing with them is to begin sending them prophets. And the prophets come in and say, "You think this is bad? Just wait. You're going to be taken out of your land, and you're going to be kept out of your land, and you're just going to stay out of there for thousands of years." And then they all say, but he's going to ultimately bring you back. He's not going to forget his promises. He's not going to forget his covenants. But he's going to punish you like crazy. So what do? Kill the prophets. It's the only thing you can do. What do? You kill the messenger. Just be quiet. We don't want to hear the bad news. At that point in chapter 13, we hear about the death of Elisha. Elisha has been the primary prophet after Elijah. There is a school of the prophets. You don't hear much about those other prophets. And those other prophets, for the most part, speak of things that are just right on the cusp, things that are going to happen. Are you going to win this war? Are you not? That kind of stuff. But again, this next phase of prophecy reaches out all the way to the end, to the ultimate kingdom, to God's restoration of Israel. So verse 14, when Elisha became sick with the illness of which he was to die, Joash, the king of Israel, came down to him and wept over him and said, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. And Elisha said to him, take a bow and arrows. What an odd response. So he took a bow and arrows. Then he said to the king of Israel, put your hand on the bow. And he put his hand on it. Then Elisha laid his hands on the king's hands. And he said, open the window toward the east. And he opened it. Then Elisha said, shoot. And he shot. And he said, the Lord's arrow of victory, even the arrow of victory over Aram, for you shall defeat the Arameans at Aphek until you have destroyed. So, okay, you're going to go into battle with the Arameans, and you're going to win. But it's not you that's going to do it. It's God who's going to conquer through you. Verse 18. Then he said, take the arrows, multiple arrows. And he took them. And he said to the king of Israel, strike the ground. And he struck it. He's shooting out of a window. And he shoots toward the ground three times and stops. So the man of God was angry with him and said, you should have struck five or six times. Then you would have struck Aram until you would have destroyed it. But now you shall strike Aram only three times. So first he gave him the object lesson. He had him shoot one arrow. And he said, that one arrow is one battle you're going to win now. Now you've got more arrows. Keep shooting. He shot three times. It was like, I'm good. I'm done. And the man of God was like, where is your insight? These are the arrows that represent you conquering. Why would you stop? Why would you quit? Keep shooting arrows. Keep winning. He says, well, now that you've done that, you're going to win three times. And that's the extent of it. Now, if this sounds familiar, we bumped into something kind of similar back in Isaiah again. I know we read about it a few months ago. Go to Isaiah 7. Let's take a look at it again. Isaiah 7. One of these instances where God says to somebody, I'm giving you just open opportunity here. And human beings, for some reason, just feel like they don't want to in any way encroach on God, and they end up coming up short. This is chapter 7 of Isaiah. And this, again, is war against Jerusalem. This is with the Arameans. This is a very similar time period and a very similar circumstance. The Lord spoke again to Ahaz, saying, Ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Make it as deep as Sheol, or make it as high as heaven. Wouldn't you love to have that offer? Mm-hmm. Like, just ask whatever you want. And God even puts the challenge out there, like, don't make it small. Don't make it a little thing. Make it big. I don't care if you dig as far down as the grave, all the way to Sheol, down to hell, or all the way up to hell. I don't, pick something big and ask me. And Ahaz, thinking he's doing the right humble thing, says, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. This wasn't a test. God was flinging open the windows of heaven and saying, ask something. I'm going to demonstrate to you my faithfulness to you. I'm going to prove myself to you. Here's your opportunity. And he says, I won't do anything. And then he said to him, now, O house of David, is it too slight a thing for you to try the patience of men, that you will also try the patience of my God as well? You should have asked. You should have asked for something. You should have gone ahead and taken advantage of the moment that God was giving you. And instead, he said, oh, I wouldn't do that. And he says, you're trying God's patience now. It's one thing that you try the patience of men. Now you're trying the patience of God. But of course, God then says, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. And so God actually does give him something as high as the heavens and as deep as Sheol, and predicts that a virgin's going to have a child, and that child's name is going to be God with us. So God does provide him with a sign. I only mention that because here in 2 Kings, you see a very similar circumstance where the man of God ends up being angry at the king because the king should have said, these are the enemies of God. These are the enemies of Israel. I should shoot till I'm out of arrows, knowing that every one of these is a signature of conquering in battle against our enemies. And he shot three. He had more to shoot. And he just stopped. He just kind of gave up. And so the man of God got mad and said, again, here was your opportunity. God was at your disposal. And you come up short. And so here's what actually happens to him. Well, we'll get to it, because those three battles actually do take place, and then they end up losing to the Arameans. So verse 20 tells us, and Elisha died, and they buried him. Now the bands of the Moabites would invade the land in the spring of the year. And as they were burying a man, behold, they saw a marauding band. The picture being here, there's some men that are burying a man, and there are these bands of marauders, robbers, that would come in, the Moabites, and they would come in and they would rob people. And so the people who are doing the funeral panic because they see the band of robbers coming, and so they just real quickly take the man and throw him into Elisha's grave. Like, well, it's quicker, easier, throw him in there. So they cast the man into the grave of Elisha, and when the man touched the bones of Elisha, he revived and stood up on his feet. Remember, Elisha had a double portion of the power that Elijah had? Even his bones laying in a grave were enough to revive somebody. Pretty interesting. You don't hear any of the rest of the story. I want the rest of the story. I want to know what happened when that guy caught up with his friends who threw him in a grave because he was dead. Hey, guys, so you're just going to dump me and run? That's your plan? I want to know what happened when they found out that he was alive again. But no, that's the end of it. We're moving on. Because as I said, the author of 2 Kings has somewhere to be. He's moving on. Verse 22. Now, Hazael, the king of Aram, had oppressed Israel all the days of Jehoahaz. But the Lord was gracious to them and had compassion on them and turned to them again. Why? Because of his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he would not destroy them nor cast them from his presence even until now. Isn't that remarkable? We've been reading for weeks and months now about Israel's faithlessness, how they've turned to other gods, how they've worshipped other gods and golden calves on the mountains, and to the Asherah and to the groves and to the Queen of Heaven, and that God has repeatedly said to him, I'm going to punish you, I'm going to show you, I'm going to teach you, I'm going to train you up. They nevertheless won't change their ways. The ways that Jeroboam, their first king, taught them to chase after foreign gods. And they will not change, and yet God remains infinitely, unstoppably, consistently faithful to them, not because of them, and not because of their behavior, but because he made a promise. And he made a promise to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And what was that promise? The promise was, this land is going to be yours in perpetuity. It is always going to belong to you, and I'm going to bring your people to this land, and I'm going to plant them, and they're never going to be uprooted, and all the nations of the earth are going to flow to them. So God has made that promise. And now we have seen hundreds of years over and over of Israel's faithlessness, and nevertheless, God will not turn or destroy them because of a promise he made. Now, I can't help but think that if God would be that consistent to Israel because of a promise he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, how faithful will he be to a promise he made to his one and only son? If he has promised his son a people, and if he has chosen those people since before the foundation of the world and wrote their names down in a book called the Lamb's Book of Life, that's how secure that promise is. These people belong to you. Before they're even here, before they're even part of history, before I've even made the planets or spun the stars, I have promised you a people. Do you think God would ever turn on that promise? It's one of the reasons that we can have tremendous confidence that we're going to be perfectly okay when we stand before God, because we already belong to his son. We are already in Christ and Christ in us. And therefore, the same God who is acting like this and being this faithful to utterly rebellious, angry people who are worshiping other gods, who will not do things his way, even though they've had every advantage, even though they do have the law and the prophets, even though they do have Moses and the law, even though they have advantages that no other nation on the planet has, they still end up turning away from God. If it was you or me, or if this was based on any kind of human sense of fairness, God would have buried them a long time ago. But he didn't, because he made a promise. And his promise is always good. His word is always good. And that's why we read the specific language. He would not destroy them or cast them from his presence. Why? Because they're his. And if they're his, that's the end of the argument. So that takes us then to verse 24. Now Hazael, the king of Aram, died. Ben-Hadad, his son, became king in his place. And then Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, took again from the hand of Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael, the cities which he had taken in war from the hand of Jehoahaz, his father. And three times Joash defeated him and recovered the cities of Israel. Remember a little while ago, I told you we looked at the fact that God had been giving up cities in Israel as a punishment against Israel. So then Joash, who should have just kept shooting arrows, decided to only shoot three, so he got three of his cities back in war. Now, that's where we're going to leave 2 Kings. Go again to 2 Chronicles, because there are important details that are filled in here. Go to chapter 25 of 2 Chronicles. And we're going to pick up again with Amaziah, who succeeded Joash in Judah. Chapter 25, Amaziah was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Jehoadan of Jerusalem. That's just kind of fun to say, isn't it? Jehoadan of Jerusalem. Say it with me. Jehoadan of Jerusalem. And he did right in the sight of the Lord, yet not with a whole heart. Now it came about, as soon as the kingdom was firmly in his grasp, that he killed his servants who had killed his father, the king. So we began tonight with looking at the servants who killed the king, and they killed the king because the king was complicit in the stoning of Jehoiada's son. But then when his son becomes king, he then killed the servants who had slain his father, the king. However, he did not put their children to death, but did as it is written in the law of the book of Moses. It's been a long time since we've seen a direct reference to the law of Moses in 1st or 2nd Kings, as these kings are constantly doing what they want to do and doing away with the law. But this king, a good king for the most part, the law of Moses had commanded, saying, fathers will not be put to death for their sons, nor sons be put to death for their fathers. Each shall be put to death for his own sin. So he followed that rule and put those servants to death. Verse 5, moreover, Amaziah assembled Judah and appointed them according to their fathers' households, under commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds, throughout Judah and Benjamin. And he took a census of those from 20 years old and upward and found them to be 300,000 choice men, able to go to war and handle spear and shield. He hired also 100,000 valiant warriors out of Israel for 100 talents of silver. So he's really building a significant army in the south now. And he's even taken good soldiers from the north, from Israel, and brought them down to pay them. But a man of God came to him saying, O king, do not let the army of Israel go with you, for the Lord is not with Israel, nor with any of the sons of Ephraim. But if you do go, do it, be strong in battle, yet God will bring you down before the enemy, for God has power to help and power to bring down. And Amaziah said to the man of God, but what will we do for the 100 talents which I have given to the troops of Israel? And the man of God answered, the Lord has much more to give you than this. In other words, let him have the money. What do you care? It's not your money anyway. It's God's money. And he'll provide for you. It reminds me of a standard practice that we've had here at GCA through all these years. Tom and I have talked about it many, many times when people have come in here and needed help or needed some money or needed something. I have always said to Tom, it's God's money. Just do the next right thing. If they need help, give them help. And we talk about it. Are we being ripped off here? Are we being hoodwinked? Do they really need help? Are we really good? Should we really give it? And we say, just do it. God has more than this. Just do it. Well, that's essentially the same biblical principle here. You've already covenanted with them for this amount of money. Go ahead and pay them that amount of money. God has much more than this that he can give you. So then Amaziah dismissed them, and the troops which came to him from Ephraim went home, but their anger burned against Judah, and they returned home in fierce anger. Now Amaziah strengthened himself and led his people forth and went to the Valley of Salt and struck down 10,000 of the sons of Seir. And the sons of Judah also captured 10,000 alive and brought them to the top of a cliff and threw them down off the cliff so that they all dashed to pieces. But the troops whom Amaziah sent back from going with him to battle raided the cities of Judah from Samaria to Beth-horon and struck down 3,000 of them and plundered much soil. Now it came about, after Amaziah came from slaughtering the Edomites, that he brought the gods of the sons of Seir and set them up as his gods, and bowed down before them, and burned incense to them. Then the anger of the Lord burned against Amaziah, and he sent him a prophet who said to him, why have you sought the gods of the people who have not delivered their own people from your hand? In other words, these gods aren't the gods that delivered your people. It is Yahweh that delivers your people. And yet now you bring them these other gods to worship. And it came about as he was talking with him that the king said to him, have we appointed you as a royal counselor? Stop. Why should you be struck down? In other words, I didn't ask you for your advice, and I'll have you killed if you don't shut up. Why should you be struck down? Then the prophet stopped and said, I know that God has planned to destroy you because you have done this and have not listened to my counsel. We're going to pick up there next week. I want to leave you dangling right there. Da-da-da-da. Because God is actually now going to punish King Amaziah, and he's going to use this time not foreign enemies. It's not going to be enemies of the Arameans, and it's not going to be the Moabites. He's actually going to cause war between Israel and Judah, the northern and the southern tribes. This time God is going to use Israel to punish Israel. And it's during this time, as I mentioned, that God is going to start sending prophets to them. We'll see that next week as Jeroboam II is going to succeed Joash as the king of Israel. This is the time of Hosea, the time of Amos, the time of Micah, ultimately the time of Isaiah. And so as I mentioned, after last week, we're going to start spending time in some of what are called the minor prophets, only called minor because they flat the third. But that was a joke completely for you. That was utterly... Well, and that was... Just seeing if you're still awake. Just seeing if anybody's still with me. Are you lost in the weeds? Are you lost in the details at this point? I know it's hard to follow all this and keep track of all the kings of the north, kings of the south, kings of the north. All you have to know at this point is that God is reaching a real peak with Israel and Judah. He has sent them Moses. He has sent them immediate prophets who have at least told them, look, this is the word of God. Call them back to Moses. You know, they'll talk about immediate wars like Micaiah, that kind of stuff. But now God is reaching beyond that. He's going to bring war between Israel and Judah. He's going to use Israel to punish Judah in this instance. And it's going to cause a division between Israel and Judah that the prophets are going to pick up later. One of the things that Ezekiel does after you read about the Valley of Dry Bones, the next thing he's told to do is to take two sticks and write on one stick for Ephraim and his brethren, and write on the other stick for Judah and his brethren. And then take the two sticks in your hand, and when you walk with the two sticks and people say, what are the two sticks about? You say, God is going to bring back Israel and Judah, and they're going to be one in his hand, and God is going to remove the enmity between Israel and Judah. This is the thing that the prophets all talk about, that eventually all 12 tribes are going to be brought together again, the same way that David ruled over the 12 tribes. It's going to be the son of David who's going to rule over the 12 tribes. And so those kinds of prophets are all going to start bubbling up now. This is the time period in 2 Kings where you're going to start seeing this, where God now is going to go past their immediate state. He's going to create this level of enmity between the northern and the southern tribes where they're warring against each other. And at the same time, he starts sending them prophets who begin telling them both. Some of the prophets go to the north, some go to the south, and they start saying, God is so against you that this is what's going to happen to you now for generations. This is no longer going to be a right now thing. But then, as I said, they all uniformly end up saying, but he won't forget you, and he won't completely destroy you because of the promises he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because of the promises that he made to David. He's always going to keep you in his mind, in his heart. He's going to punish you. He's going to correct you. He's going to drive you out of the land that he has promised you. But he's not going to leave you there. That's not the end of the story. He's also going to bring you back. He's going to restore you. He's going to feed you. He's going to establish you. He's going to give you not only rest from all your enemies around, but all of the foreign kings are going to flow to Jerusalem because you're going to be the primary kingdom on planet Earth. And this is the moment in history when God starts talking that way. So next week, we're going to see Jeroboam II. The sequel, it just keeps going. And this is going to be the time of the kings like Uzziah. And then when Uzziah dies, Hezekiah. And these kings whose names you'll start to remember and start to know. And the reason you know them is because they do play so prominently in the prophets. So you got all that? Mm-hmm. So that's where we're headed. I appreciate that the last few weeks you've been very patient as we have culled through the middle of 2 Kings, because it is rough sledding. But that has now moved us to a point where we can get to phenomenally fascinating stuff. I mean, Micah? Not that Micah. I mean, the book of Micah? some of the best stuff that you find in the Old Testament, including predicting exactly where the Messiah is going to be born, what city he'll be in. So we know how accurate he is. Some of the stuff we're going to read from Amos, you could read it as if it were today. It's so contemporary sounding. But we'll start with Hosea. I think we'll do Hosea first because it really sets the frame for the others. So that's what's coming. All right?
Yeah.
Sound like fun?
Yes.
Say goodbye to the digital congregation.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. We welcome your feedback and encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.